Florida to speak about gravity and corrections to Maxwell's equations, and co-author Katie Leonard is in the audience here in Baton Rouge as well. Richard?
Okay, very good. Thanks much for the invitation to give this talk. I'll be speaking on a paper that Katie and I wrote with this title, which has just been accepted for publication in PRD. Let's move to slide number two, the one labeled Classical Maxwell's Equations. And I think everybody is familiar with how we use classical Maxwell equations, perhaps not in the presence of a general metric. So what they would look like in the presence of a general metric is given there, where F rho sigma is actually exactly the same F rho sigma as it would be in flat space, namely d rho a sigma minus d sigma a rho. And j mu is the current density, and it really is a density, a vector density. And there are the way you would play this game in flat space is somebody would give you what j mu is and tell you what initial conditions you were interested in or what asymptotic conditions you are, and then you just solve the stupid differential equation. And I've selected three interesting choices for study there. Photons would correspond, of course, to having no current density, and there we know that the solutions are that the electric and magnetic fields are proportional to transverse polarization operators times phase factors, and by superposing those over different choices of wave vectors, you can get the arbitrary solution. A static point charge tells you about the other thing that electromagnetism does, namely the long-range force fields that it is associated with. And there the J mu would be a purely time-like point charge associated, located at the origin. And the solution, of course, is the familiar Coulomb potential. And another thing that you might be interested in electrodynamics is what's the response to a source that just turns on and off? What's the response to a pulse? And a prototypical pulse that you might make is a dipole that you would instantaneously create. And that could be done physically by taking two charges and then just separating them at an instant to make a dipole. And the charge density associated with that would be something which was zero before t equals zero and then turned on. And the current density is something that would just be an instantaneous pulse right at the origin in space and time. And what you would get from that is something, a pulse that would propagate outward. And for example, the magnetic field, the Fij component of the field strength, is just a tensor factor, di pj minus dj pi, times a pulse that propagates out at the speed of light. And we're all familiar with you know, how it is that we would derive these results. What I want to talk about is what happens when we include quantum gravitational corrections. So I want to include corrections where the metric becomes a quantum field operator. And you're used to being told, oh, that's a terrifically complicated issue, and we can only study that with S-matrix elements. And I think actually with this audience, you are as frustrated with that kind of lore as I am, because you know, why should it be that the field equations allow you to talk about the causal evolution of pulses and things, and this S-matrix formalism that we have of dealing with quantum field theory only allows us to talk about asymptotic scattering experiments, and in particular that becomes very frustrating when you deal with situations in cosmology, such as I and Katie do, where there isn't even any asymptotic condition. The universe is thought to have begun at an initial point, and nobody knows what the final configuration is. So I want to tell you about a formalism that allows you to do as much with field equations as the classical Maxwell equations do, and I want to examine the results of what happens when you include quantum gravitational corrections to these three kinds of sources. So let's switch to the third slide now, the one labeled quantum effective field equations. I've encountered in my career a lot of people who are confused, including myself at the beginning, with exactly what the quantum effective field equations tell you. So what I'm going to review is the progress in going from the classical action, which I'll imagine in terms of a scalar field theory, S of phi, to the quantum effective action, gamma, of a classical field, phi classical, or phi sub CL. And the idea is that the exact Heisenberg operator equation of motion for the field operator phi is, of course, the variational derivative of the classical action. And that being equal to zero is an exact strong Heisenberg field equation. What phi classical is something which is the matrix element between two states that you get to pick, and they don't have to be the same, and they don't have to be asymptotic in and out vacuum either. So I'll just say C left and C right. It's the matrix element of the exact Heisenberg field operator between those states. And that's what solving the effective field equations does for you. And you could, of course, just calculate that thing directly. But the effective action field equations, delta gamma phi classical delta phi classical of x equals zero, what they give you is the matrix element of the exact Heisenberg operator equations between C left and C right. And I remember when I first saw that, I thought, oh gosh, this is ridiculous, because the exact Heisenberg field operator equations, I just told you, have to be equal to zero. But this equation that I'm writing down here, the last bullet, the last blue bullet, is under a particular assumption which would not be true in general for a general phi classical. That assumption is that the so-called quantum field, delta phi, is equal to zero, or the matrix element of it between phi C left and C right is equal to zero. That's in general not true. So in order for these to be the exact Heisenberg field equations, you would in general have to have delta phi be whatever it needs to be a full solution. But if you just assume that delta phi has zero matrix element, then you'll get a non-trivial equation, which you have to adjust phi classical in order to make it be true. And that non-trivial equation is what the effective quantum field equations do. And the thing that they give you in the end is what phi classical is. And again, its meaning is it's that matrix element between these two states that you get to pick. And I think most everybody is familiar, at least from old field theory courses, with how you would go about calculating this thing. The propagators and vertices would all be calculated in the presence of phi classical. Okay, so now let's go on to the next slide, the fourth slide, which deals with this crucial issue of what C left and C right are. Now, if you were talking with a dogmatic S-matrix field theorist, what he would tell you is, look, they absolutely have to be free vacuum as t goes to plus and minus infinity, respectively. And that's not wrong, it's just too dogmatic. That's exactly the right thing for scattering. So if you wanted to calculate S-matrix elements that would be relevant for making predictions at the LHC, that would be exactly right. But if you wanted to use Maxwell's equations or any quantum effective field equations more generally to examine the evolution, the causal evolution of pulses outward from a fields outward from a pulse, that would not be a very good way of doing it for two very important reasons. Number one, the propagators and everything have both real and imaginary parts, and so you can see that the field equation that you get from that is going to have an imaginary part as well as a real part. And I'm just betting that, I haven't checked the HEPTH website today, but I'm just betting that the string theorists have not changed things so that the electric and magnetic fields are imaginary. They're actually still real the way they were yesterday when I checked the HEPTH website. And yet those effective field equations are not going to have that property. They're going to have the property that they have an imaginary part, and indeed the phi classical that you get out of it, or the E classical and the B classical that you get out of it, are going to have imaginary parts. That's again not wrong, that the matrix element of even a Hermitian operator can have a complex part, provided that the C left and C right are not equal to each other. So that's not wrong. But it's not the way that we would want to use the effective field equations. It's not the way that, it's not something that would happen in the classical field equations. And if you want a good analog of that, it's not going to give it to you. The other bad thing about these field equations is that they're not causal. So there's no way to set up an initial value problem. The propagators have support both in the past and in the future. So you're going to have to know the future in order to solve anything, and there's no way that you're going to be able to do causal evolution of stuff, and the propagators also have support outside the light cone. Okay, so they're not going to be causal. Again, that's not wrong. That's exactly the right thing to do scattering, And it's right, because the way it happens physically is that you're demanding a condition in the far future. So of course, in order to get that condition to be true, the field equations have to know about stuff that's happening outside the past light cone of the point where you're doing the evolution. But it's, again, not what we would want to do if we wanted to follow the propagation of a pulse outward from an instantaneous pulse. So the better field equations to ask questions such as the kind I'd like to ask are the in-in field equations. And that's where you make a different choice about T left and T right. You assume that they're both free, they're both equal to each other, and they're free as time goes to minus infinity. That, it turns out, will give field equations which are giving you the expectation value of a field operator. And if that field operator is Hermitian, then that field will stay real. And it turns out that they'll also be causal, because you're no longer demanding some condition to be true in the infinite future. Now, I know what you're thinking at this stage. You're thinking, oh, well, maybe that's true, but that's going to be really complicated to get. Well, that's not the case. It turns out there's a procedure called the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, which allows you to just read off those effective field equations from the in-out field equations that you're used to getting. So it's actually very, very easy to get if you can get the in-out field equations, and I'll show you the rules for doing that, and I'll actually do it to one loop order in graviton corrections to Maxwell equations. And the final choice that I'd like to mention is the one that's much more interesting for cosmology, which is where we believe that the universe began at some finite time and you just can't go to the infinite past. And that's where you set T left and T right equal to each other, but you specify the universe in a prepared state at some initial finite time. Okay, And it turns out that it's very, very easy to adapt the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism to that, too. You just start all the interactions at t equals 0, and you have to do something that you loop quantum gravity guys are very used to, and that is that you have to correct the initial state. So you have to have a full interacting state, not this free state that you depend on infinite time evolution to get to be the full state. Okay, so let's move on to slide number 5. Which is quantum correcting Maxwell. So what do the quantum corrected Maxwell equations look like? Well, the full effective field equations are, of course, going to be nonlinear, but that's almost always irrelevant. Even our very, very, very intense laser physics guys will tell you that it's very, very hard to push electromagnetism into the nonlinear regime. So let's just look at the linearized effective field equations. So we just take the full effective field equations and we just chop off all nonlinear terms. Okay, then it turns out that they take the form of, which is given in this first bullet, of the classical Maxwell equations, again in the presence of a general metric, plus a quantum correction piece, which is the integral d4x prime of something called the vacuum polarization, pi mu nu, contracted into the vector potential at x prime. And the whole thing is equal to a script j, which is the 1pi one-point function, so the one-particle irreducible one-point function. And the vacuum polarization is the one-particle irreducible two-point function. So it's the sum of all graphs which can't be cut by cutting a single line. Okay, and have two have one field, one photon in and one photon out. And I'm going to actually, although Katie's thesis project is to calculate this in De Sitter background, I'm going to specialize for the purposes of this talk to what happens in flat space, because it turns out there are a lot of interesting and fascinating issues even in flat space, and that's what we wrote the paper on as a warm-up exercise to her thesis problem. So when you specialize to flat space, it turns out you can make an incredible simplification in the effective field equations, and it comes by noting that an exact consequence of gauge invariance is that the vacuum polarization has to be transverse. That is, if you contract d mu with respect to x onto it, or d nu x prime onto it, you have to get 0. Okay? If you work in a Poincaré invariant gauge, which I will, then that means that the full vacuum polarization has to take this form of the transverse projection operator times d squared, acting on just a scalar function of only the invariant distance squared between x and x prime, which I'll call delta x squared. Okay, so that's a big simplification. And you can then just integrate by parts those operators. Of course, since delta x is just a function of x minus x prime, those derivatives might as easily well be with respect to x prime. And then you can integrate them by parts and act them back on the A mu and turn it into an F mu nu. Okay? So that makes the effective field equations take this form that I've given in the bottom red line. Okay? And let's go to the next slide, which is how you would...
So in the De Sitter case, I would imagine that your first equation is from the polarized density is still the same. It's just that you have the covariant derivative operator there. In other words, you're taking the obvious transverse projection. Is that correct?
Not quite. It is transverse, but it's a little bit more complicated than just putting covariant derivatives, because see, one of them has to be at x and one of them has to be at x prime.
Right. No, I mean the covariant version of the transverse projection. I agree.
That's right. Although that thing is quite a bit more complicated than, well, you have a lot of experience in this. You probably know what I mean, but it's quite a bit more complicated. And Katie can speak with bitter experience on this because she's been for the last, her first project with me over last summer was to try and do that for scalar quantum electrodynamics, for a previous calculation of it in scalar quantum electrodynamics that Tomislav Prokopets and I had done. And it's not easy writing down what that operator is. but yes, your belief about that is right. That's what it would be in De Sitter background.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay, so we'll go to slide number 5, which is the perturbative solution of this. Now, I wish that I could get the full pi, in which case then I could just solve the full equation. But nobody is going to do that anytime soon. The only thing you can do is, with increasing effort, determine it to a few orders in perturbation theory. And in fact, all Katie and I did in this paper was just get it to one loop order. And that's her thesis project, to get the analogous thing in De Sitter background to one loop order. And that already is a major, major, major piece of work. It's not so hard to do it in flat space, but it would be very hard to get the two-loop result. Okay, so given that you're only going to have it to some finite order, how do you make sense of it? And what you do is to just solve it perturbatively. And the loop counting parameter of quantum gravity is called kappa squared. It's different people have different conventions. Some people call it 32 pi g. I usually make it be 16 pi g. Okay. And the way you do it is, briefly, you expand everything in powers of kappa squared. So the full f mu nu is a zeroth order term plus kappa squared f1 plus kappa to the fourth f2, etc. Same for j. It's the zeroth order piece. It's just the classical current. It's what you choose to put in for your source. And then there's an induced one-loop term and an induced two-loop term. Pi, of course, is zero to zeroth order. That is, its zeroth order piece, if you wanted to speak technically, is the classical Maxwell equation. And then it has a one-loop piece, which we calculated, and a two-loop piece, which would be harder to get, but could be done. And then what you do is to plug those expansions into the equation and segregate everything to in different powers of kappa squared. So, for example, the classical part would be the first or the penultimate red bullet. And the one-loop correction is the bottom red bullet, okay? And notice that the quantum correction part of the equation comes in the form of the one-loop correction to the current and also the vacuum polarization part acting on the classical solution, okay? So those both function as effective current densities at source the one-loop correction to the field strength. Okay, so that's how you actually use it. And let's go to the seventh bullet, which starts off just giving the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian consists of three terms: the Lagrangian of general relativity, the Lagrangian of electromagnetism in the presence of a general metric, and the single BPHC counter term that we need in order to renormalize this guy at one-loop order. the way you get the interactions that you need to calculate the primitive diagrams of this thing at one loop order is to just take the second functional derivative of the classical E and M action with respect to two vector potentials, because see, you want the thing with the one particle irreducible diagram with one photon in and one photon out, so you take the derivative with respect to two photon fields, and it's still a complicated function of the metric. What you then do is to just take the metric and expand around whatever background you're interested in. We, for this paper, we're dealing with flat space, so we put in e to mu nu plus kappa h mu nu, and then you expand it in powers of h mu nu. And the first term is just something involving e to mu nu's, and then the second term gives you the three-point vertex, the two photon and one graviton vertex, and the order kappa squared piece gives you the four-point vertex, the one with two photons and two gravitons. And as an example, I give you explicitly what the three-point vertex is in the bottom bullet. Okay, and you can easily get the four-point vertex, but it turns out that you don't need it because the four-point diagram turns out drops out. Okay, so that's the vertices. You can see that they're very easy to get. The rate limiting step in doing any calculation like this is always getting the propagators. That's why only a few calculations have been done in simple backgrounds. Flat space is, of course, probably the simplest background. And in flat space, all the propagators turn out to come from the propagator of a massless scalar. This is quantum field theory, so there are going to be ultraviolet divergences, and we regulate in dimensional regularization, where we make ourselves living in d spacetime dimensions, still one time direction, but d minus one spatial directions. And it turns out that the massless scalar propagator is in d dimensions is very easy. It's just a gamma function divided by 4 pi to the d over 2. Times something involving this delta x squared. Remember, that's x minus x prime. And actually, there's an I epsilon convention that it needs, and I've given it down there. And you need to raise that to the d over 2 minus 1 power, and then that will be the exact massless scalar propagator in d dimensions. Okay, so how does that give you the photon and graviton propagators? The way that works is, of course, you have to, in order to define them, you have to fix the gauge. And since I want to take account of the simple form of the vacuum polarization, if you have Poincaré invariants, I want to use a Poincaré invariant gauge. So I add Feynman gauge fixing term in electromagnetism, and that makes the photon propagator just be e to mu nu times the scalar propagator, so that's pretty simple. And I'll work in the de Donder-like gauge for the graviton, which is just the square of dh minus 1/2 dh. That makes the graviton propagator take this simple form in terms of eta's times the scalar propagator. And I want you to note well at this point that this scalar propagator has both real and imaginary parts. And that means that the effective field equations that you get, the in-out effective field equations, will, as I say, have both real and imaginary parts. And that's one of the things that we want to fix with the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism so that we don't have this embarrassment of getting out that if you put in a real point charge, you wind up with an electric field that has an imaginary part. Okay, so let's move to the next slide, slide number 9. And I bet you all, took quantum field theory courses where you did loop integrals at one loop order, and you probably thought, as I did, that that was hard. It turns out that working in position space actually makes it much easier. There's no integrals at all in position space at one loop order. You just multiply propagators and vertices together and take whatever derivatives you're asked to take, and that's it. So the one loop vacuum polarization consists of the sum of these three diagrams. The first one, the most complicated one, involves two three-point vertices, a single graviton propagator and a single photon propagator. The next most complicated one involves just a four-point vertex and a graviton propagator. And the final one is just the renormalization counter term. Okay, so let's write out what the three-point one is. it turns out that it has derivatives on x and derivatives on x prime that act on the outer legs, then a three-point vertex, then a graviton propagator, then another three-point vertex, and then derivatives acting on the photon propagator. Okay? And remember, all of those things are, all of those propagators are just etas times the scalar propagator, and indeed the vertex functions are just etas. So you have some huge contraction, and you just do that, and out at the end comes some simple factors that come from the scalar propagators, square of the two gamma functions and the pi's. Oh, I think that should be a pi to the d instead of a pi to the d over 2. I think that's a typo. And then some factors of d that come from taking all the traces. And then something that involves the two free indices, mu and nu, and some delta x's. And it turns out, as I told you all, that that's transverse. You can just write that as the transverse projection operator acting on 1 over delta x to the 2d minus 2. Okay. Let's look at the next slide now, which gives you the other two diagrams, the 4.1 and the 3.1. So I've the 4.1 and the counter term. So I've summarized the result that we got for the pi. That's the thing without the transverse projection operator from the 3.1 on the previous page. The 4.1 is even simpler. It just consists of some derivatives acting on a four-point vertex times the single graviton propagator, which is coincident, by the way, it has the two points equal to each other, times the derivative of a delta function. And it turns out that in dimensional regularization, that graviton propagator just gives zero, because the rules of dimensional regularization are that whenever you get zero raised to a d-dependent power, no matter what d dependence it is, you always set d to be such that that's a positive value. No matter what you have to do, even if you have to make d negative, it doesn't matter. You always make it be so that that's 0 to a positive power. And of course, setting x prime equal to x makes delta x equal to 0. So we just get 0 for that that particular diagram. And that, by the way, is right. That's called the automatic subtraction of dimensional regularization. So that one was real easy to get, too. And the final one is the counter term. And that is, as you might expect, the transverse operator, which is what would be there for Maxwell, and then the two extra derivatives that you need for the BPHZ counter term, and then the delta function. Okay. So that means that the pi counter term is just you take away the I and the transverse projection operator, and it's just that. Okay. So let's go to the slide number 11, which is renormalization. So we've got this weird non-local three-point contribution, and we've also got the counterterm piece. And the three-point contribution looks like it's not singular, but your eyes are deceiving you there. It actually does become singular when x prime is equal to x, because it's an inverse power of x prime. And we do have to do that because the field equations call for us to integrate this thing up against the zeroth order field strength. Okay, so how are we going to make sense of that? And the answer is, what you do is you take the 1 over delta x to the 2d minus 2, and you integrate by parts. You write it as d squared of something. And remember, delta x just depends upon x and x prime. It depends on x minus x prime. So you can write it as d squared of something or d prime squared of something. Big, big advantage to write it as d squared of something, because you're doing the integral with respect to x prime, and d can just be taken outside the integral. Okay? So you just keep doing this and doing this and doing this until you get the 1 over delta x squared to be a low enough power that the integral of that is convergent. Okay, so it starts off in four dimensions. It starts off being 1 over delta x squared to the sixth, and that would not converge if you integrated it d4x prime. After the first partial integration, it's 1 over delta x squared to the fourth. That still has a logarithmic divergence as you if you set x prime equal to x. But after the second partial integration, it's now just 1 over delta x squared. That becomes singular when x prime equals x, but it's an integrable singularity if you integrate d4x. Okay, and if that was all there was, we could just go ahead and take d to 4 at that point. But you notice that the act of doing this partial integration introduces some 1 over d minus 4s, right? You see the 1 over d minus 4 there in the first red line? That means that you can't, right at this stage, take d goes to 4. What you have to do is to add 0 in the form of exactly the scalar propagator equation. So you remember the scalar propagator had a 1 over delta x to the d minus 2, and it obeys the equation that d squared of it gives a delta function, right? So 0 is equal to d squared of 1 over delta x to the d minus 2 plus a local term, a term that involves just a delta function. And that's very important because you see in d equals 4, the 1 over delta x squared to the 2d minus 6 is exactly the same as 1 over delta x squared to the d minus 2, right? And that means if you add the two together, they will cancel at d equals 4, and their difference is just going to be of order d minus 4, right? And so if you add 0 in this form, you get the 2 to cancel up to order d minus 4, which cancels the 1 over d minus 4, and now gives you a term which is both integrable in d equals 4 and finite in d equals 4. So you can go ahead and take the unregulated limit. And then you've segregated the 1 over d minus 4 onto the delta function term. And what do you do with that? You absorb it with the BPHC counter term so that the two exactly cancel. And what you're left with now is the finite vacuum polarization. So I've written it down in the bottom red piece. And of course, that's only at one loop order. There'd be a two loop order and a three loop order contribution. OK, well, now we've got it. Now we could go ahead and quantum correct the effective field equations, except, of course, that delta x squared has both a real and an imaginary part. And that's going to give this inconvenient and bizarre feature that the effective field equations would take real fields and turn them into complex fields, and that's craziness, right? So now we're going to deal with the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, which I promised you would give you very, very simple rules to convert in-out results, such as we just got, into in-in results, okay? And I'm not going to derive it. I'll just give you the rules for it. The rules, it's like many things in physics. The derivation is a little tedious, but the rules are vastly simpler than the derivation, and that's all you need in order to do the calculation. Okay, so there's just actually 4 rules of relevance. The first is that every propagator, of course, has 2 lines, right? If it goes from x to x prime, it has an endpoint at x and an endpoint at x prime. In your mind, assign each of those a plus minus polarity. Okay, so every line endpoint could have either a plus polarity or a minus polarity. Vertices in the Schwinger-Keldysh rules are either all plus or all minus. The plus vertices are just the same as in the normal in-out calculation. The minus vertices just have an extra minus sign. Okay, and then you just make every diagram that you can make. And of course, there are going to be propagators that have 2 pluses, propagators that have a plus minus, or a minus plus, or a minus minus. And remember, every single propagator just involves this delta x squared thing. The only thing you need to do in order to get the Schwinger-Keldysh propagators is make different replacements for that delta x squared. So in the plus plus case, it's the normal one of the in-out formalism. In the plus minus case, you take off the absolute value, and you change the sign of the I epsilon term. In the minus plus case, you just reverse the sign of the I epsilon term. And in the minus minus case, you put back on the absolute value and again reverse the sign of the I epsilon term. The final rule of the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, and I'm just giving you the rules, I'm not deriving it, is that since every line has a plus minus polarity and both of them occur, you can see that if you had an endpoint function in the old in-out formalism, since every one of those n lines could have had a plus-minus polarity, you'll now get 2n point functions in the in-in formalism. Okay? And remember, the thing that we need to quantum correct the Maxwell equations is the two-point function and the one-point function. Okay? Well, how do you get the Schwinger-Keldysh field equations? Again, I'm just going to give you the rules. I'm not going to derive it. It turns out that what you replace the in-out thing that I calculated for with is the 1pi two-point function that's the plus-plus and the plus minus one, so the sum of the plus plus with the plus minus. And it turns out that will solve both of the embarrassments that the, or by the way, on slide number 13 now, that will solve both of the embarrassments that the in-out effective field equations have. The first embarrassment was that it's not causal, right? It involves stuff in the infinite future and stuff outside the past light cone. Well, if you go back to those propagator rules and look at what they are, you'll see that if you add together the plus plus and the plus minus terms, whenever t prime is greater than t, it turns out that the plus plus contribution and the plus minus term will just exactly cancel each other. And further, that cancellation will also be true whenever you're outside the light cone. Okay, so if delta x squared has the spatial separation, which I'll call delta r, minus the temporal separation. It's the temporal separation which has that I epsilon term. So if the spatial separation is actually bigger, then you don't need the I epsilon term. And then again, the plus plus term and the plus minus term cancel. So you don't get any contributions at all outside the light cone, and you don't get any contributions in the future. Hence, the only contributions you get are in the past light cone. And within the past light cone, the plus plus term and the plus minus term are just complex conjugates of each other. So in fact, they add up to give exactly the I that you need in order to cancel the I that was occurring in the effective field equations, and you wind up with a explicitly real piece. Now you remember that the term that we wound up getting was two derivatives, or a d4, acting on logarithm of u squared delta x squared over delta x squared. Okay, you remember we got that. The first thing that's useful is to extract another derivative out of it, and you can do that by writing it as 1/8 of d squared times a logarithm squared minus 2 times a single logarithm. And now just use these rules of the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism that I told you. So you put together the plus plus term and the plus minus term. They come in with a relative minus sign because one of the vertices is a minus vertex in the plus minus term, and that will give a minus sign. And that means that you're adding together these two logarithms that I give in the penultimate red bullet. Okay, and they just add together to give I pi times delta t minus delta r, which is only non-zero when delta t is positive and when delta r is less than delta t. In other words, when you're within the past light cone. The logarithm squared term, of course, gives one of the logarithms left over, but it also has the theta function, which forces you to be within the past light cone. So the upshot of all of that is that the pi that goes into the effective field equations is just g over 24 pi squared times d6 of a theta function, which forces you to be in the past light cone, times this logarithm minus 1, and then you could go to order g squared if you wanted to. Okay, so now I've got it. I've got effective field equations which are as good as the Maxwell equations. They're real and causal. Okay, and now I'm going to use them, and I'll use them for those three sources that we considered before, namely no current at all, the free photon case, and a point charge, and a instantaneous pulse. Okay, so let's go to slide 14. Which is what happens with photons. So let's write down the effective field equations. They're the classical Maxwell part plus this quantum piece that we've laboriously calculated now, and it's equal to a script J. And by the way, Katie and I did not quantum correct the current, okay? So we probably should have done that, but we didn't do that. So we're just using the classical currents. Well, for photons, it doesn't make any difference because for photons, the current is just equal to zero. And then you see that d nu f nu mu is equal to, it gives you an exact solution. And that actually should be true to all orders in perturbation theory, not just this one loop calculation that we did. Now, you might at this stage be a little bit worried and say, yeah, but maybe there could be an extra solution where df was not equal to zero, but the DF term, classical DF term, canceled the one loop term. And indeed, there usually is such an extra solution, but perturbatively, you're ordered not to go for it. Okay, so perturbatively, that would be just an artifact of having cut off calculation at a fixed loop order, because you see that would give you a solution that that had the classical piece going like 1 over kappa squared, and that's a no-no in perturbation theory. So in fact, the only solution that there is perturbatively is just the classical one. So photons get no corrections at all. Let's go on to slide number 15, which is more interesting. So that's what happens when we consider a static point charge sitting at the origin. And there, the thing to calculate is the Coulomb potential, and it starts off as the classical piece, Q over 4 pi r, and then it has a fractional correction, which is 2g over 3 pi r squared, plus, of course, the two-loop contribution and higher. Now, actually, that has been known for a long, long time. You can get that by S-matrix techniques, and it was gotten by S-matrix techniques. And in fact, even by common sense, you can see, just by dimensional analysis, you can see that the correction has to take the form of some number times g, which when you put in the h-bars and c's is a length squared, is the Planck length squared. So the only other length in the problem is r squared, so it has to be g over r squared times some number. And notice also, for those of you who were a little bit worried by the fact that I was adding in a BPHC counterterm, and of course that would have a completely unknown finite part, you might have thought, oh gosh, that finite part is going to make big changes in the thing, and we don't know that, we can't do anything at all. You notice that that just exactly dropped out of the calculation. So even though it was there in the effective field equations, it drops out for this particular source and makes no contribution at all. So rest easy, at least at this order, the finite part of the counterterm makes no contribution to that result. This is a real, legitimate prediction of the quantum theory. It's not terrifically interesting because it's saying that you don't have big changes until you get down to the Planck length, so we can't do anything with it, we can't measure it, but that's what the result is. And actually, this this kind of result had been obtained previously by the old-fashioned techniques, the ones that didn't let you look at causal evolution and where you had to just look at scattering stuff. So the earliest calculation along those lines was one done by a graduate student of Schwinger named Rutkowski. And that was done way, way back in 1970, back when I was, either in junior high or high school. A more recent calculation was done by Dirham Bohr, and they both get the same sign. In fact, Rutkowski and I get exactly the same number. Dirham Bohr calculated not with a point particle, but with scalar quantum electrodynamics, so he got a different constant in front, but the same sign. We all are getting that that what quantum gravity does is to make the Coulomb force stronger. Okay. And that's actually kind of bizarre because the renormalization guys, the people who calculate the beta function of quantum gravity, get the opposite result. So Robinson and Wilczek did that calculation in 2006, and a more detailed and probably more accurate calculation was done by Horst and Reuter just last year, and they both get that the beta function causes gravity to flow in such a direction that the electrodynamic coupling constant should become asymptotically free. Now that's actually not quite in contradiction, because there's more things that go into a calculation of whether quantum gravity should strengthen electrodynamic forces or weaken them. So the S-matrix things should be complete results. They are giving the right answer that quantum gravity strengthens electrodynamic forces. The beta function, you need to also put in the gamma function corrections and the initial seed wave function, and those could change the result of the beta function. So those results are not quite inconsistent with each other, but there is a little bit of tension between them. Okay, let's move on to the 16th slide, which is the third classical source that we considered, which is where we create an instantaneous dipole at the origin at t equals zero. Okay, so we're dealing with what happens with a point dipole. And I give you again what the current density and the charge density are for those things. And the induced, let's study the magnetic field. So the induced Fij takes the form of something which is 0 before t equals 0 times dipj minus ejpi, and then times something. and the something depends on what loop order you're at. So all corrections, all terms in the perturbative expansion of this thing take that same form. At zero loop, it's just 1 over 2 pi times delta of r squared minus t squared. So it's this Linert-Dieckert potential propagating outward, where r squared is just equal, where r is equal to t, and it just says that it propagates at the speed of light. The one loop correction takes the form.
Can I have a question?
Yeah, sure.
Hi, sir. It took me some time to find the microphone. Concerning this difference between the S matrix and the beta function regulation, right?
So let's go back to slide 15. 15. Good.
Yeah, so just to clarify, so I thought that the calculation by Robinson and Wilczek, for instance, and such, those they were looking at quadratic divergences, taking the Planck length as the regulator.
That's right.
In the S matrix calculations of donor, that's just the bare G Newton, and they are calculating these loop corrections, but they don't need to regularize because these are just slapping to the Coulomb potential, so this comes from non-analytic terms, so there's no need of regularization. Such as
that's right, too, and you saw that in my effective field equation, the mu dropped out.
Right. Oh, okay. So you are more in the Gerobor or Donahue setup.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's move on to slide 16, which is the third thing where we're studying a pulse that propagates out from t equals 0, where we create an instantaneous dipole at t equals 0 and the spatial origin. And I've given you the currents, the classical currents. The induced Fij takes this form of the curl of p times scalar thing, and the scalar thing at zero loop order is just delta of r squared minus t squared over 2 pi. The one loop correction is minus 4g over 3 pi times the derivative with respect to r squared of the scalar, of the zeroth order thing. So if you just added those two things together, you would say that what we're looking at is sort of the Taylor series expansion of delta of r squared minus t squared minus 4g over 3 pi. Of course, there's higher order corrections, but at least at the order we're looking at, it's clear that what's happened is that the light cone has been pushed out. Okay, so instead of r squared being equal to t squared, which is ordinary propagation, r squared is equal to t squared plus 4g over 3 pi. Okay, so we've pushed the light cone out by something proportional to the Planck length. Okay, that is superluminal. It's actually not superluminal in ways that many people have speculated, so I'm not making the speed of light be bigger than c. It's not like a new speed of light has happened. What's happened is that the light cone has actually just been pushed out by some constant amount. If you think about it, that's inevitable from the way that the calculation was done. Okay, so if you calculate in perturbative quantum gravity, there is no way that you're ever going to see a violation of Lorentz invariance. So the only thing that you can ever see is something that is r squared is equal to t squared plus some constant, namely a completely Lorentz invariant relation like that. Okay, so that's the only way that you ever could have seen superluminality in perturbation theory. Let's move to slide 17, because I think that this whole thing is really the most interesting part of the calculation that we did. And this is the slide labeled smearing of the light cone. It's a very, very old idea. It was done just as I was sucking my first breaths. Pauli was talking about it. Deser was talking about it. Deser told me that his father-in-law, Oscar Klein, was talking about it. And the idea had nothing to do with acausality. It had to do with trying to get better control of ultraviolet divergences.